This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new United Nations-backed report highlights the massive destruction caused by invasive species on a global scale. The report was published by the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. It looked at over 3,500 invasive species across the world. It estimates that invasive species cost society $423 billion every year. Invasive species also cause about 60% of extinctions. They're so widespread, they've even made it to Antarctica, where invasive grasses have been introduced. Our next guests are experts on invasive species here in Wisconsin and beyond. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you run into some invasive species in Wisconsin? Are you battling one of them maybe on your own property? Or do you have questions about the impact here in the state and elsewhere? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison. She served as an advisor on invasive species and climate change to the National Science Foundation. Carol, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We've got this big international report. Carol, can you help us understand the scale of the invasive species problem?
Well, the scale is enormous. As the report says, invasive populations are causing huge economic costs. For example, according to the World Health Organization's Guide to Ship Sanitation, about 10 billion metric tons of ballast water are transported through ship traffic every year. This is incredibly costly. I work on aquatic invasions, and the scale is just incredibly enormous. We're talking about billions and billions of tons of water moved throughout the year, causing large numbers of invasive populations to enter novel habitats. That's just one example.
Brad, people might wonder, you know, species have moved around through the millennia, you know, it moving into new environments all the time. Why are things different now? What is it about our current invasive species situation that makes it so easy to throw things out of whack?
Right. That's a good point. And, you know, we're in a time of globalization where it's very easy to move around the world. And, you know, at times we either on purpose or inadvertently move species with us. And they're moving in ways that they would never be able to move on their own. So crossing oceans and, like you mentioned, grasses getting to the Arctic. And so the scale is much larger and happening much quicker than it would just, you know, in a natural way.
Carol, Brad mentioned sometimes intentionally spread things like horticulture, exotic pets also contribute to the problem. I believe we used to plant purple loosestrife, for example, in Wisconsin.
Yes.
On purpose. We don't do that
Yes.
anymore, I hope. How big a part
Right.
of the story is that?
That's a huge part. I think the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry are pretty large contributors. So the biggest factor that correlates with the rate of invasions is our trade volume in general, shipping trade, cargo trade, et cetera. But definitely the garden, I think we need to fundamentally change how we garden and plant native species. So the horticulture industry, the pet industry, the aquarium industry, people releasing invasive plants in their gardens, releasing aquarium fish into lakes, such as the African cichlids in Florida. These are definitely contributors to the larger problem.
And Brad, I mentioned invasive species often contribute to the extinction of other species. How big a problem is that?
That's a major problem, and this report definitely highlights that. And it's not only, you know, a single or even multiple invasive organisms that can displace native species. It's multiple stressors. So we have the stress of climate change and, you know, fragmentation and pollution. And then you couple that with the introduction of a brand new species that does not have predators, for instance, and is able to outcompete native species. And all these multiple stressors, like this report illustrates, have really serious consequences for biodiversity.
Talking to Brad Herrick with UW-Madison Arboretum and Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, looking at invasive species. A new United Nations-backed report puts a huge multi-billion-dollar annual price tag on them. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with an invasive species in your own backyard. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carol, the report named the most widespread invasive animal in the world, the black rat, the most widespread invasive plant in the world, the water hyacinth. What is it, and Brad started to touch on this, what is it that makes some species so successful when they're introduced to a new and different environment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. This is multifaceted. There's usually not just one factor, but multiple factors. So there are extrinsic factors like the environmental conditions that enable them to invade, and also intrinsic properties, such as the traits that a population might have or an individual organism might have, or their genetic composition, such as how much genetic variation there is in the population. So if there's sufficient genetic variation, if there's something about the novel habitat, like lack of predators, lack of competitors, those are factors that would contribute. So there's multiple factors that enable a population to become invasive. One thing I want to emphasize is that not all introduced populations become invasive. There's a subset that do, and that subset tends to be either really good at spreading or they're really good at evolving to adapt to novel conditions. So there's a series of different factors involved.
Brad, you've been on the show in the past talking about one invasive species we have here in Wisconsin, a kind of jumping worm. Can you tell us a little bit about the history and impact?
Right. So this is a relatively new invader to North America, at least in terms of its spread. It was introduced a while ago into a couple of different states, but the last 15, 20 years, it's really spread. And the Arboretum here on campus at the University of Wisconsin was the first record in the state of this invasive earthworm. And basically the concern is that these earthworms, like all earthworms do, they consume vast amounts of organic matter. So whether that's leaves that have fallen on the forest floor or compost and mulch that you put down on your garden, they consume it so rapidly that it depletes nutrients that are really important for plant growth. It causes soil erosion because there's nothing able to hold the soil in place in terms of the plant roots. And we're seeing now they're spreading throughout the United States, into Canada, they're in Mexico. And so they are, in some sense, a generalist invader, invading multiple climates and habitats. And so it's one that is relatively new, and it follows a previous earthworm invasion. And some people don't appreciate that in Wisconsin and upper Midwest, all earthworms are non-native. And many of them are invasive. So like the common nightcrawler, one that's very popular with fishing and gardening, is considered invasive. And so we have sort of a second wave now of earthworms coming in that are really fundamentally different from that first wave. And so we're just sort of catching up now in terms of research, learning about the potential impacts.
And Carol, what species in our waterways do you have your eyes on?
Well, my laboratory has worked on zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and invasive plankton. So one thing that people often don't think about is with ballast water dumping, tons and tons and tons of planktonic species are being dumped into the waterways. So I'm interested in a lot of those crustacean plankton species that are also being introduced in massive scales. So Great Lakes invasions is especially what I'm interested in. I'm also looking at invaders in Europe and invaders all over the world, but mainly aquatic invaders is what I have my eyes on.
And how do those zebra mussels and others, and we've talked about them on the show before, what kind of impact are they having on our freshwater waterways in the state?
Well, you can probably see them. Anyone who's gone to the shoreline can see them taking over. they not only they're filter suspension feeders, so they eat up all the plankton, planktonic algae that are in the water, making them unavailable for other species. So the water might look clean, but they're also taking out a lot of the food from the waterways that other populations or species might want to consume. They're also displacing a lot of native mussels, like uniodon mussels, which are slower growing. They're also encrusting any physical structure. So they're physically altering the habitat by growing over anything. So without an abundance of natural predators, they're just kind of taking over in terms of population growth. So the zebra mussels invaded first, and now the quagga mussels are taking over. And that's a common pattern that's also happening in Europe and in other locations. Usually the zebra mussel is a faster invader. Ultimately, the quagga mussel takes over and becomes more of a problem in the long run.
We're talking about a new United Nations-backed report on the global impact of invasive species. Carol Lee is with us, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, solutions, possible solutions. What do you want to see done to address the invasive species problem globally and maybe in your own backyard? Do you think non-native plant and animal species need more controls on them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Carol Lee, professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at UW-Madison, and Brad Herrick, ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, looking at a new report finding that invasive species cost over $400 billion globally each year and cause massive environmental destruction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mary is with us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you all doing?
Good. What do you want to ask about?
Well, I have sort of a question, but I guess I'm asking more for comments or information from the guests. Where invasive species are considered, I'm wondering about the definition and whether there's an expiration date on that. And I'll give you the example that's bringing this to mind for me. I have heard for a good while and heard repeated again Australian dingoes called an invasive species. And there have been in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, plenty of initiatives where thousands upon thousands of dingoes were hunted down and killed in Australia. I think of that animal as being pretty quintessentially Australian, and it turns out there's pretty good reason for that. They've been there for thousands of years.
Mary, I gotcha. Carol, is there a definition where we might say, okay, it wasn't there originally, maybe it came over with humans, as I believe the dingo did in Australia, but after a few millennia, it gets to count as part of the local landscape?
Well, I think we need to think about the context for invasive populations. It is true that some populations become naturalized. For instance, if you look at the work of Bern Blossi at Cornell University, the garlic mustard on the East Coast has been there a lot longer than in the Midwest. So garlic mustard is highly invasive in the Midwest, but on the East Coast, it's becoming naturalized. Over decades, it has evolved to become less invasive. And the natural populations, the competitors, have evolved to be able to compete with the garlic mustard. So there is an evolutionary context. So over time, an invasive population can become naturalized if we let the native populations evolve, either to prey upon the species, native pathogens to infect this invader, or native species to compete with them. So there is some kind of, as the caller said, expiration date when they're no longer invasive. But this is a long time period. And we do need, when the invader comes in, we do need to protect the native species so that they could evolve in response to the invader and not get extirpated, not go extinct.
Mary.
I'm wondering if that answers the question.
Sure. Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Before we go back to our callers, Brad, I want to start to touch on some solutions. When we have a species like, say, a jumping worm, what are some of the things we either maybe could have done to prevent it showing up or to turn it back once it's here?
Well, in terms of most invasive species, it like Carol alluded to, it really depends on the context. It depends on, you know, how early an invasive species is identified and if there are controls that are readily available. You know, the first thing when it comes to, you know, whether it's jumping worms or any invasive species, is education. It really, and, you know, having folks understand what the species looks like, what it is, where to find it, what its potential impacts are, and really, explaining why it's potentially problematic that we have these species. And then you sort of gain trust and you get some buy-in into helping to control. Prevention is, like in the medical industry, prevention is the best medicine when it comes to invasive species. It's by far the most cost-effective. There are, depending on the species and the context, there are, you know, some technologies that are being developed to, deal with some invasive species. There are controls, depending on the context, but those are really labor intensive often and sometimes cost prohibitive. And so, prevention, education, slowing the spread, that's really where it starts.
Let's go back to our callers. Yes. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. In my previous employer and where I work now, we've gone through some quite extreme measures for controlling quagga mussels and zebra mussels, namely through chemical injection. And at my previous employer, it kind of came on to us rather rapidly. And before we realized, by the time we realized we had a zebra mussel problem, they were already causing some pretty catastrophic consequences in our cooling water systems at my employer. And that's what I wanted to bring up.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. And Carol, that goes, I think, right to your interest there. Once we have zebra mussels and quagga mussels, what can we do about them?
That's a really difficult problem. There's many different methods that have been proposed, like chemical methods, mechanical removal, thermal treatment, UV light, low frequency magnetism. Somebody also wanted to introduce bacteria. There was a scientist that called me once. He wanted to look at the experiments I was doing and wanted to test using a pathogen bacteria. And I was not particularly keen on that because we don't know what effect that pathogen would have on other Great Lakes species. There's people that want to introduce serotonin to affect the physiology of the organisms. I think there are a variety of methods that are proposed. I do think that it is important to clamp down on them to reduce their numbers so that the native populations can survive and eventually evolve in response to them. I do think we need to be careful about some of the solutions and methods because that can introduce a whole nother can of worms. For instance, introducing a pathogen could kill off other native populations. Introducing chemicals could also be problematic. So I think very rigorous testing is required. There are a variety of methods out there. I like the mechanical method, but we do need to reduce their numbers to allow some native populations, native species to survive and not go extinct. We do need to be careful about the methods we're using and think carefully about their consequences.
I want to ask each of you, thanks again for that call, Mark. I want to ask each of you for maybe a couple items from your wish list, policy changes you might like to see made that would help prevent the spread of invasive species and help support the native species. Brad, let's start with you.
That's a big question.
Yes.
I think it starts with federal funding to really be able to inspect the borders in a way that can clamp down on some, especially some of these newer ones, or newer invasive species. So it, and even at the state level, we have a great Department of Natural Resources that have regulations in place for invasive species, but very little enforcement ability, just given the scale. And so funding to come up with education, prevention ideas, new technologies, but really at the border, preventing the introduction of new species. So we have our hands full with the ones that are already here.
And Carol, if I could zoom in on one you're working on, I believe in your own yard. You think we could have some policies that might help our native plant species in particular?
Yes, I have a pretty long wish list, but I'm only going to name a few things. I think we really need to regulate, and some people hate the word regulation, but we really need to regulate the horticulture and aquarium industries. For instance, you could go online and order the worst invader in our local habitat and plant it in your yard. And our own gardens are a huge source of novel invaders. So we need to fundamentally rethink and change how we garden, as I mentioned earlier. And we should encourage the planting of native species. For instance, our highways. When I was living in California, they were planting invasive Australian ice plants along the highway, one of the terrible invaders there. So even our government systems, our institutions should be encouraged to plant native species. I mean, and we should fundamentally rethink what we think is beautiful. Why is the Kentucky invasive bluegrass the default beautiful thing that we plant in our lawns? Why are we planting invasive species, all these lawn plants, when we could actually regard our native prairies as beautiful, which will support native insects and other native populations? So we need to rethink what we consider beautiful and really promote our native populations. And we need to let areas go wild. Disturbance is something that promotes invasive populations to enter new habitats. Instead of, you know, constantly turning over and disturbing habitats, we should let certain areas just, you know, go wild and leave.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guests, Carol Lee and Brad Herrick, with us for a look at invasive species in Wisconsin and beyond.